Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Brett Easton Ellis, whose latest novel is Imperial Bedrooms, a sequel to Less Than Zero. Earlier novels, Lunar Park, Glamorama, American Psycho, The Informers is a collection of stories. Brett Easton Ellis, when I interviewed you about Lunar Park, you were talking about this book. And one of the things that you mentioned was that in terms of it being a sequel to Less Than Zero, it's kind of a strange sequel because most people remember the movie, not the book. You give a shout out to the movie at the beginning. Was that always your intention?
Once I figured out who the narrator was for Imperial Bedrooms, meaning once I figured out what Clay was doing now in his mid-40s, and I realized that he was, in fact, a screenwriter and working in Hollywood, it became apparent to me that it would be a good idea to open the book with him reminiscing about the film that had been made from the book that starred Clay. And now, if you can follow that, great. If you can't, I think it's clarified in the opening chapter of the book. But it was there from pretty much on in the outline. Yeah, I was thinking of opening the book with sort of a critique of the film, mostly because the film was so different from Less Than Zero. The film of Less Than Zero bears little or no resemblance to the novel Less Than Zero. And in a way, Imperial Bedrooms, in that opening chapter, is an attempt, I guess, to reclaim the book in a way. Because a lot of people, as you said, remember the movie. And they think the movie is the book, when in fact they're two totally different animals.
Well, when I've spoken with people who've gone back to earlier characters from years ago, like Anne Lamott went back to her characters after like 15 years, the difficulty is sometimes in finding the voice. Was that a problem here, or is it because Clay is so much older that the voice is going to change anyway?
Well, that's partly true. Yeah, that does happen, I guess. Since all of my books are narrated by men of a certain age and of a certain class, there are specific patterns to the narration that I have to follow as a writer. And I spent a long time thinking about how something like, say, Imperial Bedrooms would be narrated, just as I thought about how Patrick Bateman would narrate American Psycho. It's a long process, and there are many things that I as a writer would notice that narrator wouldn't notice. And so when I was working on Imperial Bedrooms, first of all, it was fun. I liked going back to that kind of minimalism that was in Less Than Zero. But it's a different kind of minimalism now because Clay is hungrier, he has appetites, he's much more focused, and he's not drifting around as passively as he once was. But I didn't find it very hard to reclaim that voice and to move it from the 19-year-old into the 40-something-year-old.
It seems that he's far less passive, but he has to be because he's a successful man.
Well, he's a successful man, but he is also a raging narcissist, and he is obsessed. He's a bit of a masochist, and he finds himself getting caught up in this cycle of, well, it's typical of Hollywood. It's basically exploitation of falling for young actresses and promising them parts in films that he's involved with, and then sometimes seeing it through, but other times he's a romantic, and I think he actually believes that these liaisons, these scenarios, the situation that he finds himself in with these young actresses are going to lead to something else. And when, in fact, of course they don't, because it's about exploitation and it's about quid pro quo. It's a central narrative myth of Hollywood where people do exploit each other. It's just a fact. I mean, that's how the business works. You could take exploit out of that sentence and put in favors. People do favors for each other constantly in that town, and that's how a lot of things, you know, how a lot of things work. I mean, and it is a metaphor in Imperial Bedrooms. On a certain level, I do it every day with producers in terms of a script or project, meeting with the director. If you do this, I can do this. If you want to do this project, maybe we can see if this project falls through. If we go to this director, will you do this? I mean, it's a constant thing in this town. In Imperial Bedrooms, it's more specifically about the actress-producer relationship, I guess. Since I'm not a producer, I don't find myself in that situation as often as I might like.
Well, you were an executive producer, I believe, of The Informers.
The Informers, yes. I actually was more of a hands-on producer on that film, which was an adaptation of those short stories of mine. Well, look, honestly, I have to say firsthand, There was opportunity presented to me during the pre-production of The Informers that I was quite surprised by. I had never had a script of mine turned into a film before, and I was out in L.A. and we were casting the film, and it was surprising. It was a surprising year and a half of my life. At the time, it was a little bit shocking. In retrospect, I can sit here with you now and laugh about it. And look, it certainly did influence a lot of what's going on in Imperial Bedrooms. I mean, a lot of what was going on during the 3 years I was working on the book, I'm not going to say exactly mirrors my life at all, but it did inform it to a degree.
Do you think some of the negative elements may have seeped into parts of Lunar Park as well?
Of course they did, but I now look back on this process of doing press and talking about the books after I finished them. They've been done for me. By the time I'm talking about the book, you know, on a radio station or something, the book has been over for about a year and a half.
Right.
Then I find myself talking about the book, and I always say, God, I was in a really dark place when I wrote the book. And I've noticed that that's happened like about every time that I've published a book, that there was some dark thing that happened that led to me writing the book. I don't think I'm necessarily in a dark place now, and I don't even think I'm in a dark place when I'm working on the book, but certainly books come from times of pain and stress and certain questions that you're grappling with about your own life, and a book forms from them. So, yeah, a dark place maybe while I was writing Imperial Bedrooms, but by the time I was finished with the book, I think I had exorcised a lot of demons, which also, by the way, happens when you write a novel.
One of the, I guess, the questions that I confront people with, and they feel like it's a confrontation, is when I say toward the end of an interview, what did you learn from writing the book about yourself? And they give me this look like, oh, my God, that goes in too deep.
Oh, that seems too bad, because I would eagerly answer that. I don't know if I can eagerly answer it specifically, but with each novel, yes, there was something I learned about myself. And if it wasn't that I learned something specifically about myself, it was that I let go of something that had been bothering me. I know, for example, and I've talked about this a lot, but I can't reiterate it enough, but writing Lunar Park really did exorcise the ghost of my dad, which had been haunting me for a long time. And part of what happened when I wrote that book was the pressure and the stress I felt about our relationship and how it didn't come to any kind of conclusion, because he died very suddenly and I wasn't speaking to him at the time of his death. But writing that book was a closure for me, and I have not had those negative feelings about him since I completed that book. Now, the book, I didn't set out to do that with the book. It just that it happened when I finished the book. And Imperial Bedrooms, you know, same thing, but, you know, different things that not only I learned about myself, but I also learned to let go of, you know, because so much of why you write a book, at least in my case, comes from things that bother you, that are distressing to you.
Do you think then this is a combination of letting go some of your Hollywood experiences? I mean, I can also see where it's clearly a letting go of that part of you that wrote Less Than Zero as well.
That also suggests, well, no, I guess it doesn't suggest a kind of pragmatism. It's a very emotional thing, you know, working on a book. And I really wasn't thinking of letting go of Less Than Zero, because I never felt like I was holding it so tightly. I mean, as the writer of Less Than Zero, I'm amused. I'm amused that it's 25 years later and there is an anniversary edition of the book coming out. I find that amusing as hell. Okay, because that was a book that was written not to be published. I was very young when I wrote it. I thought I'd publish other books after that book. But I do not have the same feelings about Less Than Zero that I think the audience does. So there was no – I didn't feel any kind of hurdle to cross in terms of writing Imperial Bedrooms, which I do think some fans will feel is a bit of a betrayal and a bit of a disappointment, because they're expecting – Less Than Zero Two, the party continues, whereas that's really not what Imperial Bedrooms is at all.
The whole sequelitis that we go through is, you know, that people go through, and we see it in Hollywood all the time, is that they want the same thing, but they want something different at the same time, and you can't really do that.
Well, I think Imperial Bedrooms is pretty different, not in the way that people might want it to be. That's probably the problem, but Yeah, you're right. But that's why I never looked at Imperial Bedrooms as a quote-unquote sequel. And it really wasn't constructed as one. I just really wanted to know where Clay was. And that's what haunted me. And I was also reading a lot of Raymond Chandler. And again, as we talked about earlier, the Hollywood experience, which was not great, also started to influence the book. And there you have it.
Well, the character of Rain, who's a young actress, well, she's not a very talented actress. She's a bit too old for somebody starting out. She's essentially just ambitious, trying to get a grasp on her. There's a feeling that this, even though she's empty, that there's a lot going on there.
Well, there is a lot going on there. Clay just doesn't ask the right questions. I mean, the problem with a novel that's narrated by an intense narcissist is that he's only interested in himself, and he's only interested in his appetite. And since he's a narcissist, he thinks this entire story is really about him. And as you read the book, there's, without going into too much detail, there's a kind of conspiracy at the center of it. And Clay, being the narcissist he is, thinks he is at the center of it, when in fact he is not. But because he's a narcissist, he pushes himself into the center of it, which causes even more kind of collateral damage for the characters that surround him. So, yes, Rain is a bit of an enigma because Clay has made her that way. And if Clay had asked, and he's constantly confronted by this with other characters in the book, if he had asked the right questions, if he had noticed, paid attention to things other than his own needs, things might not have turned out as badly as they do.
Well, there's a line that keeps getting repeated to Clay throughout the book, which is, Clay, this isn't about you.
Yes, and as the narcissist he is, he ignores it, and he just moves on. So, yeah, I just felt like time to confront that thing, that the narcissism thing. I don't know. It was floating around me too heavily to ignore.
Well, this is that Bob Dylan line, you know, something's going on, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And I kept thinking of that because he knows something's going on. He doesn't know what it is. Does Bret Easton Ellis, if you were to parse the book, did you know what was going on?
Well, you have to know, you know, to a degree. I mean, I do a kind of a voluminous outline of every book that I write, and that's a couple of years in the making. And in that outline are tons of questions that I ask myself and then that I answer. That can be pages long, and I chart out the plot. And I make a graph of where I think everyone is when they're not on the page, for example. But then Clay comes into play. And I realize that from Clay's perspective, he is only going to see part of that chart, part of that graph. It's the same thing with Victor Ward in Glamorama, which is a conspiracy a million times bigger than the one in the heart of Imperial Bedrooms. Again, there was only so much that character, being the kind of guy he was going to notice or was going to see. Look, if it was written in the third person, you'd probably get a lot more information, but I don't necessarily think that would be a more interesting book. You know, I think that a lot of the mystery is not answered. Enough is answered to, I think, be, for readers to be okay with, but there are some intriguing questions, and I think they're even more intriguing left unanswered.
One of the problems in seeing the ending of certain TV shows, such as Lost, for example, is that those questions are not answered. And there's got to be a balance, I would think, that you're trying to make, at least they didn't, between the questions you don't answer and the certain amount of payoff that the audience is going to get.
Well, then I think a lot of people would find Raymond Chandler miserable because his nothing is figured out. But he's also perhaps the greatest writer of that genre. Now, why? Because he has got a gripping style. He's asking almost existentialist questions that are far more intriguing than the mysteries that start off the novels. The journey of Marlowe in those books is much more interesting than whatever the conclusions are. And the questions that are raised about the immorality of his landscape that he's wandering through trying to stay true to just being his own man is much more interesting than the mystery. I don't know. I mean, that's what I was influenced a lot at that moment. But I'm of the school where I think the questions are usually much more interesting than the answers. So I don't know. That's just how I operate. That's just how I work.
You're listening to an interview with Bret Easton Ellis, whose latest novel is Imperial Bedrooms. A lot of Imperial Bedrooms, putting aside the plot per se, got me thinking a lot about Hollywood and about the nature of success. I think those of us who sit at the edges of that world often think about what it would be like to have that kind of success. And is it a success that's worth anything? You make a comment, and this is about how you were perceived years ago. Your identity is being consumed by the narrative that's been created. And to paraphrase, people you meet think the narrative is the real you, but it's not. And that could be very, very troublesome.
Oh, it can be. It was for many, many years. I mean, now I'm at a point where I just don't care anymore. Hey, want to be the narrative? Here. Give me a hug. I mean, whatever. I mean, it was just something that was really shocking when I was younger. Let's just put it that way. And it lasted for a long time. I mean, I understand how people want to identify me as the guy in the books. I get it. I mean, I'm usually the same age as the characters that I'm writing about, and I have a similar background. But I'm not. I'm different from them in many ways. And, you know, I'm just not those guys. But people want to think that I am. So I had to dismantle that for myself. I had to learn to accept it, and I had to learn to just let it go. But while it's happening and you're realizing that the world is looking at you in this way that you are not, and they will always look at you that way, it's scary. It was scary. And I had a little bit of a lot of anxiety over that, that Bret Easton Ellis represents this brand and this thing. That, you know, you talk to friends of mine, I'm just not that guy. I'm not this, like, dark prince of, you know, American letters that the press loves. I mean, they love that idea. It's a narrative that they can follow, and I'm sure my publisher likes it as well, and it helps probably sell books. But in terms of my personal life and what I'm really like, there's very little resemblance. And I'm sure my publisher wishes that I would shut up about that and say that, you know, I, you know, beat up some hookers last night or something. I don't know.
The other thing I was thinking about in terms of that and in terms of how people respond in a book like Imperial Bedrooms and how Clay responds to people, there's got to be a paranoia because anyone you meet when you're in that world is going to be viewing you through a very, very, very colored lens, and you don't really know who they are simply because they can never know who you are.
Well, this is why the theme of paranoia has run through all my work, I guess. I mean, when you realize that, when that happens to you and you realize that this is, in fact, your world, I know it sounds like a princely problem, you know, a very lofty kind of intellectual problem, but it isn't. It really becomes an emotional one, and it can cause you to become dysfunctional, realizing that everyone is walking up to you at a party, smiling with their hand outstretched for you to shake, and you're with three other friends who they're not doing that to because you are who you are. It is alienating, and it does encase you in this kind of bubble that makes it very difficult to form friendships, let alone relationships. But you just deal with it. I mean, you know, I don't know what else there is to do about it. It also gets easier with age, you know, to just, like, accept it and to say, well, this is what it's like. And, you know, if they want to meet you, they want to meet you regardless. They want to meet you because they like your books. And that's not such a bad thing. And maybe they can get to know the real you. I don't know.
Getting back to the book, the character of Rip, he's had some surgery or something done. In the back of my mind, I kept seeing Mickey Rourke.
Interesting. Well, I kept seeing no one because it was just a character to me for 3 years that I was working on. And I don't really place faces to any of the any of the people when I'm working on a novel. Even though James Spader, I don't think, has had a lot of work and played the role of Rip in the movie, that's what I have been thinking about lately when people have been talking about a movie. But I get what you're saying about Mickey Rourke. Yeah. Well, Mickey was in The Informers, and so I had met him a couple of times. And, you know, it's its own story. But it happens a lot especially in Hollywood. There are plenty of men who have had a lot of work. I think there's a website devoted to them called Men Who've Had Bad Plastic Surgery Who Now Look Like Middle-Aged Lesbians. And I think there are a lot of actors on that site. You know, sometimes work is good. Sometimes you got to be careful. Men always, I think, have to be careful when they're talking about a knife. Men cutting their face, it always looks weird. You just got to, like, deal with it, you know, naturally.
not long ago, Mick LaSalle, the critic for the Chronicle, in talking about Hollywood facelifts, made the comment that we know the bad ones. We know the Meg Ryans or, you know, Nicole Kidman and her Botox, but we don't know the good ones because they were good.
That's true.
Where are you living now?
I'm living in L.A. now.
You're still in L.A.?
I'm still in L.A., yeah. I'm back in Los Angeles, and I've been living there for about 4 years now.
Now that you're kind of separated a bit from the business, well, you're not really because you're still working on screenplays.
Well, I'm separated. No, I'm not separated from movies or TV, though I have to, like, you know, clarify that I am not as successful a screenwriter as Clay is in the book. Everyone says, oh, Brett moved out to L.A. to become a screenwriter. I moved out to L.A. for numerous reasons, and some of them happened to be that there were a couple of film projects that I was interested in pursuing, and there were a couple of TV things that I was interested in pursuing. I didn't go out there to try to get, like, contracts at the studios to reboot the Predator franchise or anything like that. It was just because of certain passion projects I had. I'm very much working within the film and TV. I just am not really a part of the publishing business.
Who are Jeremy Blake and Teresa Duncan?
Well, they're the subject of a movie that I want to make, that I've written the screenplay to, and that I've been kind of working with Gus Van Sant on overseeing. I don't know if he's going to direct it or not. He says no, he says yes, he says no, so I don't know. He's now in a no phase, which is very worrisome to me. I'm going to see him soon in Portland, and we're going to talk about this some more. There were a couple, a very big art couple, who became famous in the early aughties, I guess. She designed video games and then started to make short films, and they were successful enough to get her a two-picture deal with Fox Searchlight in Hollywood. He made digital paintings, and Beck noticed him and got him to do some videos for him, and Paul Thomas Anderson liked him and got him to work on some animated sequences for Punch Drunk Love, the Adam Sandler movie he made. And they were kind of like the it couple. They were very, very beautiful and very popular. And to make a long story short and to give you the pitch, she lost her mind in Hollywood. She was trying to get a movie made, and there were all these expectations for her, and she couldn't get the movie made, which, by the way, is what happens. The movie never gets made, but she couldn't deal with it, and it unleashed something unstable in her. And so she went mad, and she started blaming a lot of people for this thing not happening, primarily Scientologists. She went on an attack against Scientology. And so she killed herself, and then a week later, he killed himself. Jeremy did. It's just a story that haunted me. It hit me at the right time when it happened. The double suicide happened in the summer of 2007. And I just have not been able to get it out of my head. So I started to develop a screenplay, and I got some producers involved, and Gus Van Sant got involved, and we're just going to see what's going to happen with it. But it's the main project that I'm interested in right now.
Is it possible that if it doesn't work out that way, you could rewrite it as a novel?
No. It's not a novel to me. It spoke to me as a movie. It's interesting. You know, that's an interesting question, because the things that do speak to me as a novel, why? Why them, and why not the saga of, you know, Jeremy Blake and Teresa Duncan? But I don't know. For some reason, I just see their story as very, very visual. Maybe because they were visual artists. I don't know what it is about them that I see a very visual movie, and I don't see a kind of interior novel about them.
You found out about them by reading an article.
Yeah, there were a lot of articles, and there was a lot of news about it at the time it happened. But there was a particular article that I read in Vanity Fair by Nancy Jo Sales, that the producer's option, and that's kind of what we're going off on.
Well, IMDb lists something called The Frog King.
The Frog King. Ugh, The Frog King. That's so sad. It's the saddest project. The biggest disappointment was The Frog King. It was a romantic comedy that I wrote, and it looked like it was going to go. Joseph Gordon-Levitt was attached, and Darren Star was going to direct it, and everything seemed to be happening, and then, like it does happen, it completely, you know, fell apart. Like a lot of projects, you have to let it go. It's not going to happen.
You refer to the film version of The Informers as a disaster.
There are things I like about it. I want to preface disaster with things I like about the disaster, okay? And it was a learning experience. Let's just put it that way. It was a learning experience. It was the best script that I'd written, maybe the best script I'll ever write. And because of that script, we got a lot of money to make it, and we got a lot of great people to be in the movie based on the script. And then, you know, you realize maybe it's not the right director, but you're in the middle of the shoot. Maybe they went the wrong way with this. Maybe the tone is wrong. Maybe doesn't get it. So you've got all this footage, and then ultimately, what was this big, you know, epic view of Los Angeles in 1983 has been whittled down to a 90-minute movie that is missing like half of itself. What do you do? But it's actually a kind of beautiful 90-minute movie, and it's got some good music in it, so I don't know. But it was a truly stressful, upsetting experience, and it played out in slow motion for at least 2 years, and now I'm just finally letting go of it.
You were kind of hoping for a shortcuts kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's really what me and Nick Jarecki, who was the co-writer on it and was actually going to direct the movie at one point, yeah, that's how we saw it, and it's just not how it turned out.
How can you, Bret Easton Ellis, maintain now, at this age even, your own sense of self when you're so aware of the cautionary tales in books like Imperial Bedrooms or one of your favorite writers, Bruce Wagner?
Maybe that is how I deal with
really?
It. Maybe because I'm halfway living it. And so I've got one eye, you know, I'm warning myself on one hand, and then I'm living the life on the other hand. I'm pretty self-aware, and so I don't see myself slipping into the, I guess what you're talking about is what, the Hollywood cliche, or even worse than that, the F. Scott Fitzgerald, the Faulkners, who, you know, I think we've learned enough about them to realize how to avoid the pitfalls of something
right.
like that. I don't know, and it's also a new world. I mean, I really do think that there are a lot of opportunities in television and in film for writers that are pretty abundant in a way. I did not move out to L.A., first of all, to work in Hollywood. There were just projects I wanted to do, and I'm not dependent upon Hollywood in terms of, like, supporting myself, whereas I think they were, and that it was primarily a money thing for Fitzgerald and for Faulkner. And since I'm not really even in their league, I tiptoe around the idea that I'm even putting myself in that pool.
There's a TV show called Entourage, which is kind of the flip side of Imperial Bedrooms. I wonder about something like that, because it seems awfully exhausting, just living that life. I wonder also, when you're looking at Entourage, if it's an advertisement for hell and people don't know it.
When I moved to L.A. 4 years ago, I would meet a lot of young people who would come up to me, and when they realized who I was, would shake my hand and said, "Man, you wrote Less Than Zero. That's the reason I moved to Los Angeles. Cool." So on one hand, you will always have people seduced by the surfacey glamour of L.A. Granted, a moron knows that. All right. Then there is another side to the business that is, you know, undeniably grim. And I think that what Entourage purports to be about and how it presents itself is something that I can no longer relate to after living in L.A. for 4 years. Now, I liked Entourage when it first came on, and I thought it seemed very funny and kind of knowing. And then it started taking itself very seriously. An advertisement for hell? Yeah, certainly. I mean, I can see that. But also, can we just take a deep breath and say, it's just another TV show. It's just another HBO show. I did talk about how Entourage, at a certain point, began to disgust me, I guess. I couldn't watch it anymore because knowing really how it is and seeing how Entourage presents itself with a kind of frat boy lightness and taking a delight in an industry that can be very, you know, disappointing to someone creatively, financially, however it is.
We're all talking here about Hollywood, and I mean, it makes sense in terms of the fact I'm interviewing you about a book that's about Hollywood. But then we have to also ask ourselves, what's the role of Bret in circuses, the Hollywood role, in terms of the larger American narrative, in the sense that it's the celebrity culture is also a distraction from what's really going on?
I talk to people who are like, you know, 23, 24. No, the celebrity culture is not a distraction at all. It is what's going on. It's not a distraction from what's going on. It is what's going on. Branding yourself, getting your own website, putting your blog out there, having 10 different avatars. It's just that we're moving into a new world. I think that it's just the way it is now. And it's, you know, technology has enabled us to do this. And it's not pink. It's not black. I'm not painting it either way. I'm not making any judgment on it. I don't really go out that much in terms of promoting myself. I put out a book, and I feel obligated to go out and do press for it. And, you know, and I do the press. And it's always interesting to see what's out there and, you know, talking to people who are interested in books. But I don't really see myself as someone who has chased this in a way that other people have chased it. I mean, chasing it meaning chasing fame, chasing publicity. I do what I do, and that's about it. I don't know why I'm patting my back suddenly and why I'm suddenly so self-congratulatory. I'm not even really answering your question. I'm kind of going off on some kind of, like, Brett is okay routine.
It's not about you, Brett.
I know. Why? Now you know why I wrote this book. Now you know why I wrote People Better. Oh, no, I've been found out.
Brett Easton Ellis, when I walked into the radio station, I saw you reading on an iPad, and you looked at me and said, you know, I wasn't sure about this stuff, but I'm getting a little bit closer to being okay with it.
Oh, yeah, I am. I definitely am okay with it now. I was resistant about it because I am old school. I'm old school. I like a book. I like holding a book. I like turning the book's pages. I like the tactile, sensuous quality of a book and its cover and even the feel of the Knopf pages, Knopf being the publisher that has a really wonderful kind of book that I just love the way they look. You're right. On an iPad, nah, it's not the same thing, but it is different than a Kindle. Someone brought an iPad over to my place about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and, you know, I was just looking at it kind of like agog. It was like, whoa, the books look great. They look so much better than they do on a Kindle. And it really reminded me that this is the future. I mean, books are going to be digital things. There will always be books printed, just like there will always be vinyl available to people who want vinyl and, you know, CDs for people who want CDs. I believe there will always be, like, you know, hardcover books for people. But I do think the majority of reading will finally be done on things like the iPad. And I used to have a problem with it, but I don't anymore once I saw how beautiful books actually look on an iPad.
Brett Easton Ellis, as you said earlier, you finished this book a year and a half ago. What have you been working on since?
I've been working on scripts, and I've been working on primarily that script about Teresa Duncan and Jeremy Blake called The Golden Suicides, and I've been working on various other scripts and mostly just working in film and on television and trying to develop this TV show. And also, during that year and a half, I'm also editing Imperial Bedrooms and going over it with copy editors and with my editor, and I've been over it like 50 times in the last year or so, so that's also been part of it.
Have you begun thinking about another book or short stories?
I haven't. I'm always thinking about other books all the time. I'm always thinking about, I mean, it's just something that I can't help. I mean, I'm, you know, a writer and I've written novels, and so it comes into my, ideas come to my head a lot. Nothing's landed. Nothing's landed or stayed with me yet. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on with that.
Well, back in 1985 and the 80s, there was that Brat Pack, you, Tammy Janowitz, Jay McInerney. You know,
so
you were like the literary analog to, you know, the Hollywood Brat Pack. You and Jay both seem to have landed on your feet with a lot of quality books.
Yeah, I love Jay. Jay's a great guy. I never really took the Brat Pack seriously. I always thought it was kind of a joke. And we certainly did not call ourselves the Literary Brat Pack. It was something that the press invented because it was, I don't know, sexy. It was the narrative, like, you know what, young writers running around New York and they have bestsellers and they do cocaine and isn't it all great? Oh, my God, the Literary Brat Pack. You know, it was just something that I kind of, I guess, endured. And I still, I guess, to a degree, you know, when people ask about it, I try to find some funny stories about it, but I never looked at it as a literary Brat Pack. Basically, it was me and Jay and, I guess, Tama, who I really never knew that well. I really never hung out with Tama that much. But I was close with Jay, and then they added a couple of editors at that time who were young and hip and had longish hair and liked to do blow. I guess that's how they got involved in this group. And it lasted for about 5 or 6 years, and then it was over. And I went on to do – I mean, I got kicked out of everything because of American Psycho. So I was kicked out of the Brat Pack for that book. Then it ended. I see pictures now from that time. There was just an article in New York Magazine where I turned the page, and there was this photo of me and Jay and some model he was dating in 1989 or something. And it came – it, like, kind of punched me in the gut. It was so shocking to remember that, oh, yeah, that's right. That's how people viewed us during that time.
Brett Easton Ellis, one final question, and now I'm going to come back to a question I got into earlier. When you walk away from Imperial Bedrooms, you said you're exercising demons, you're doing something. Do you have a specific idea on what exactly you walked away from? I mean, what did you pull out from that? Now you're free.
We touched on it briefly. really, it is the idea that it isn't all about you. I think it's human to believe to a degree that the world, you know, revolves around you. But then you hit an age where you realize, no, the world really doesn't revolve around you. You are just one of millions of players in the world. And I think once you hit that point and you let go of that, well, then there's freedom.
You've been listening to an interview with Bret Easton Ellis, whose latest novel is Imperial Bedrooms. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.